Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Hello and welcome to Disability Day, the Pride International Day of Disability, and the theme is Disability Pride. And this is Marissa from the Doin' Time Show, and today I'll be working to do the broadcast in regards to the lived blindness, the lived experience of vision impairment and blindness. And freedom of speech is usually the normal program today, so in case listeners have just tuned in to listen to freedom of speech, that's not happening today, but they will be back next week at the same time. So first up on the show, we're going to be speaking with Ricky Chaplin, and he'll be speaking about the disability insurance scheme and looking at some of the challenges that blind and vision impaired people have had to face in terms of what's happening with the implementation of plans. Then after that, we're going to be speaking with Julie Phillips, who is the manager of the Disability Discrimination Service, and she'll be documenting some cases in regards to discrimination and around the Disability Discrimination Act in regards to blind and vision impaired people. After that, we'll speak with Duncan, who is running a furniture design business and also has a vision impairment. So basically today's broadcast is on the empowering topic of the lived experience of blindness and vision impairment, which can never be taken away. We will concentrate on the areas of life that blind and vision impaired people wish to speak about on the day, including a historical focus of what it is like for older blind people before technology. And then last but not least, we'll speak to Vivian Pelchick about her lived experience of blindness and some of the things that she had to go through in terms of her education and other areas of her life. So stay tuned, and hopefully we'll be speaking with Ricky soon.
You're listening to a 3CR 855 AM on International Day of Persons with, well, they call it disabilities. I don't.
Hi, I'm Des McIntosh. December the 3rd is International Day of People with Disability.
So don't assume just because a deaf person is deaf, they can't be interviewed on radio. They can.
What if you couldn't piss unless I said so? What if you couldn't eat unless I fed you real slow? And what?
You know, I'm not a fan of what they've replaced cripple with. Special needs? Really? If there's one thing I've learnt being a cripple, it's that special is just a code word for shit. Special schools? Shit. Special buses? Shit.
You're listening to 3CR 855 AM on International Day of Persons with, well, they call it disabilities. I don't.
So do me a favour, babe. Spend your life in my world.
And you're back with special disability programming today. Now, unfortunately, we haven't been able to get Ricky as yet on the telephone, but instead we are interviewing Julie Phillips from the manager of the, she's the manager of the legal discrimination legal service. Julie, how are you? It's Marissa. Welcome to the program.
I'm good, Marissa. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Now, before we proceed, I'm wondering if you could just correct me and just elaborate on your title and the name of the organisation.
Sure. I'm the manager of the Disability Discrimination Legal Service.
Fantastic. Julie, thank you for making yourself available. I mean, we were talking off air the other day about looking at different cases and different areas of life and challenges that blind and vision impaired people have experienced over many years. And I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit about the organisation and some of the things that the cases that have happened in regards to disability discrimination.
Sure. So the Disability Discrimination Legal Services is a community legal service, which means we're free. And we assist people with disabilities who believe that they may have been discriminated against. So we do provide education sessions for people with disabilities and people that work with them to explain the law to them and explain the types of things that can constitute discrimination. We also obviously assist people legally in that we give legal advice, and if we believe someone has a complaint that fits under the discrimination legislation, either in Victoria or Australia, we assist them to make that complaint, we assist them with mediations, we can assist them going to court. So we get a variety of queries and questions from people who are blind or visually impaired, and it's important to realise that a lot of this unfair treatment that happens in the community and that we get called about is unfortunately not discriminatory because the laws are quite rigid, and so sometimes we get calls from people with treatment that is clearly unfair and inappropriate, but we can't assist them with because it actually doesn't breach the law. But we do receive complaints from people that do breach the law. And would you like me to give you a couple of examples?
That would be great, yeah.
So one of the most common ones, I guess, but it seems to be petering out and probably more common years ago, was, of course, the treatment of guide dogs and the allowing of them into taxis and hospitals and eating places. We're finding, because that's probably got a little bit of a higher profile in recent years, that is probably less common than it was maybe 5 to 10 years ago. But it still does happen. So we get some other sorts of complaints. For example, we've had a complaint recently in relation to assessments. So if you go to school or university, you will be assessed in a certain way, and universities and schools and TAFEs have assessments which are often standard assessments, and often they haven't thought about how a person who's blind or visually impaired will be able to actually access that assessment without being disadvantaged. So
that's a new one. What does that entail?
Well, for example, anything that's in a document, as you would appreciate, if it's going to be accessible to a person with a visual impairment or who is blind, will need to be provided in a different format. So for some people, that might be a requirement to provide it in Braille. For others, it might be to provide it in a way that some software program can convert text to speech, and vice versa.
Right.
So there's a number of programs around. And so each assessment that is used to be being provided in some standard written form needs to be made accessible to the individual. So there might be some assessments where a person has a little bit of vision but just needs to expand, have everything expanded, but the actual format of the assessment is such that to expand it in a manner which the software does makes it pretty inaccessible, either too lengthy,
right.
Lots of different problems. So we will often have queries about the rights of people who are blind or visually impaired to have something changed in a manner which they can access, or a request that they be provided with extra time because the manner in which they've got to access the assessment document takes so much longer that they cannot meet the time requirements for that assessment. And sometimes the schools or the universities or the accreditation people will be suggesting that is giving the blind person an unfair advantage because there's often a misunderstanding in the community that doing something different for a person with a disability, they don't understand that you often need to do something positive and different to make them on the same playing field as others, and they interpret it as a leg up, if you like, which it isn't. So we've had that sort of query. We've also had, for example, somebody having difficulty with the busy intersection and the requirement for just trying to think of the audio tactile devices.
Sure. Yeah, the signals. Yeah.
Yeah, because those intersections can be quite dangerous, especially if they're major intersections. Perhaps also in the workplace where, again, there are systems that an employer or a business may use which have been tailored or off the shelf to assist someone do a job. It could be an accounting system. It could be a payment system, which just isn't in a format that is accessible to the software that is available for blind and visually impaired people, or again may require extra time because it's onerous, and therefore an employer might start criticising the employee and suggesting that any mistakes they make or any extra time they require is something that is their fault rather than a fault with systems not being accessible.
And that's after they're employed, obviously. You're talking about that or before?
Look, it's often after. I mean, look, you know, people getting knocked back on the basis of their disability is obviously another issue. And, of course, sometimes it's really hard to ascertain that because unless a prospective employer comes out and says, look, I'm sorry you didn't get the job because you're blind, which they're not going to do.
Oh, I've been told that.
Oh, have you?
Oh, heaps of times.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
I mean, as a vision impaired woman, you know, like I'm actually a qualified social worker, and it's always good to have meaningful discussion, isn't it, Julie? And you know, I've been told straight. Oh, there was one time, and I won't mention the organisation due to confidentiality clauses, but you know, there was one time where I was told, "Look, you're actually a menace to our community. You're blind, and we're not going to give you this job." And I had to actually jump the fence. It was a country area and I had to walk home. I got lost, but, yeah, I got back all right.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah, well, so, yeah.
Most employers are too smart or too tricky, I might say, to say that out loud. And therefore you've kind of got to draw an inference about
absolutely
these things. And, look, if you're very tenacious, you can make a complaint. And then through the course of that attempt to get documents about the other people's resumes,
absolutely,
for example, and sometimes you might easily find that you actually were the most qualified person for the job.
Oh, yeah. Have the outcomes been good?
Look, yes, most of these matters actually settle, which is great because hearings and trials are pretty stressful for everybody involved and they take up people's time. As I said, very stressful. They're the sorts of things that if you can get a good result during a mediation process, you would want that to happen. And so we actually find that most of our complaints do get mediated with all sorts of remedies such as apologies, changes in the sorts of systems or assessments, which can be quite groundbreaking, of course, because if a person who's blind or with a vision impairment is going to have a standard assessment, there are going to be lots of people after them that are going to do that as well. And also if they're using particular software programs that are not accessible, it's likely then the future others will as well. So when we can get some outcomes that involve the changing of those assessments or systems, they're really quite good.
That's good.
They give a systemic outcome. And compensation as well. And often apologies too. So there's a range of sorts of things you can ask for as a result of making a complaint. And it's great when people go away are feeling they've been heard and
Absolutely.
Also seeing some very tangible response to their complaint.
Absolutely. And just a quote from the BCA, Blind Citizens Australia Commission, the Blind Citizens Australia, they wrote a submission to the Productivity Commission in regards to the NDIS.
Yes.
And, you know, before you were just talking about the students. And it says at the tertiary level, Blind Citizens Australia continues to receive complaints from TAFE and university students about inaccessible digital learning platforms, accessible format material not being provided in a timely manner. And lecturers having no understanding of the accommodations they need to make for people who are blind or vision impaired. And basically what's happening now is that the university is actually trying to fob everything off onto the niece. instead of, you know, actually attempting to deflect responsibility for themselves.
Yeah, and schools are trying to do that as well. And look, it is the service providers or the educational authorities' responsibility to make their services accessible. That's in the law. Anyone can read it. And so it's not really fair at all to expect the NDIS to come in and pay money or support people for responsibilities that are not theirs. And I think that's a shame because we all know the NDIS, you know, is blowing out. And the last thing we need is costs being transferred to them that are unnecessary and properly the responsibility of others.
Absolutely. Could you just give some details of where people can call, people with any disability, not just blind or vision impaired yeah. people, if they wish to get some legal help?
Sure. So our website is www.ddls.org.au. And if you missed that acronym, it's just the acronym for Disability Discrimination Legal Service. Or we can be called on 9654 8644. We have an email address on the website. We're located in Ross House in Flinders Lane, which is very handy because there's a lot of disability organisations actually in the same building, including Blind Citizens. So we've got a very handy location, so some people just drop in to make an appointment.
Lovely.
We also take most of our appointments by phone. So if people live in a place where it's not easy to get there, they can simply phone up and we have lawyers who will speak to them for up to an hour relating to their experience.
Julie, thank you so much for coming onto the program. And I know we don't really have enough time to discuss the process of a disability discrimination complaint, but I do want to say to listeners that you know, you do have your mediation conferences or conciliation conference. You don't have to go to court straight away, and often those complaints are resolved during conciliation, aren't they?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Julie, thanks so much. Enjoy the rest of the weekend. And,
you're very welcome.
Whether you're disabled or not, I think all of us have got some type of disability.
That's right.
Happy International Disability Day.
Thanks very much, Marissa.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Mental illness has a bit of a hard gig, I think, in all forms. And I think that I suppose it's about saying accepting difference and accepting different behaviour and accepting difference in other people. I suppose within the disability sector, is there a hierarchy of disability? I don't know. Are there judgmental attitudes in the disability sector itself? I don't know. But I just know that mental illness, because it's an invisible disability, because you can't see the broken brain that produces the behaviour that we show sometimes, because it's an invisible illness and an invisible disability, it's hard for people to accept that we have an illness and that we have a disability. So even within the own sector, it's about people accepting us for who we are. And generally speaking, society doesn't deal with difference at all well. So how do we break down those barriers and say to a wider society, it's about accepting difference in all its manifestations. And because I have a mental illness, you know, I have a different difference.
Most of the time, if you call up and say, is this place accessible for a person in a wheelchair, or is it accessible for a person with a vision impairment or other disabilities, most of the time they would say yes, and most of the time the venue is not accessible because they don't know what accessible is.
And you're back with disability programming, and anybody who has tuned in for freedom of speech, it's actually not on today. We're actually doing the International Disability Day programming, Disability Pride, and if you wish to listen to freedom of speech, they'll be back next week. Now I'm just going to go into another announcement. We still haven't gotten on to Ricky Chaplin, who is the advocacy officer at Blind Citizens Australia. So I'll just go into another announcement, and if we can't get onto him, then I'll just read out the submission that Blind Citizens Australia, or part of it, that was prepared by BCA some years ago. So I'll just put on a couple of more announcements until we see what's going on.
Most of the time.
Hi, I'm Maurice.
And I'm Mario.
And we're
Chronically Chilled.
a program that aims to provide a platform to those living with chronic and invisible illness, as well as exploring topics that impact on our daily lives.
Listen to Chronically Chilled the first Wednesday of every month at 6 p.m. starting December 6th.
And you're back with the disability programming, and we're still not able to get Ricky Chaplin, but thankfully we have been able to have the lovely Vivian Palchik coming up on the line, and we will be speaking with her shortly about the lived experience of blindness. Hello, Vivian. Welcome to the program. Hello, Vivian. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Marissa. Thank you very much for inviting me on your show.
You are an absolute legend for coming onto the show. We've been unable to locate Ricky Chaplin. So
a bit earlier.
Yeah, maybe you slept in. But it's approximately 1:21, and we're celebrating Disability Pride today. And I have a very special guest on the line today. Vivian has been a personal friend of mine for many years, and we have also enjoyed peer support together as vision impaired women, and she has been tremendous support for me in regards to, working out Braille literature campaigning and all sorts of things. And we've supported each other, haven't we, Vivian?
Yeah.
So, Vivian, I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit about your lived experience of blindness, and I know that you wanted to also talk about the NDIS, and feel free to just talk, and talk about some areas of your life that are important. I know off air you were talking quite a lot about education and mobility and all sorts of things, but before we actually get onto that, I just wanted to just make an introductory comment here. And just a quote from the BCA submission that was given to the Productivity Commission. I know you actually did your own submission.
Yeah.
But the submission says, when it comes to services like orientation and mobility training, it can be very difficult for a participant to calculate how much support they might require over a 12-month period. If, for example, an individual suddenly has to relocate or learn how to get to a new workplace, they may require intensive orientation and mobility training to enable them to navigate these new environments safely and independently. Support for transport costs may also need to be increased for the period during which the individual is still learning how to use public transport to access their workplace, etc. So I mention that because I know that the NDIS, they only have limited funding, and anyway, I'll let you speak about what you want to speak about in terms of your own lived experience. Go ahead.
Well, orientation and mobility is, I feel, one of the most vitally important areas of blindness-related services, and I just feel that it is not being catered for properly and not being offered at a comprehensive level as it should be. When I did my submission about the NDIS, in fact, I raised this very issue because at the time it seemed to me that a lot of the dialogue and the narrative around the NDIS, even with relating to blindness stuff, was to do with guide dog training. And I'm, there I am thinking a non-guide dog user who doesn't want one anyway. I'm thinking, well, all right, what is actually being done to address the enormous gaps I feel exist in orientation and mobility training, in particular for cane users? Typically what happens in my experience, certainly, and with many others I'm sure will attest to this, that one is put on a waiting list when you contact an agency for the blind, like, for example, Visibility or Vision Australia, whoever it might be. And what happens is you get put on a waiting list, and, of course, when you get an instructor, then it's typically the case that one is often relegated to once a week training.
Yeah, that's not really enough, is it? Because you've got to learn all the spatial concepts, and it's not just about navigating from A to B, is it?
That's right.
How has that affected you, Vivian?
Well, I feel that perhaps in the beginning it didn't really matter so much, but as one reaches for greater independence, I think then you start to really realise how much that can impact when you're actually being put in a situation where you're reliant on sighted people for transport, perhaps more than you otherwise would be.
Do you feel that way for yourself?
Yeah, yeah. I feel that the taxi scheme has certainly helped. It's a great help for us, but that worries me too, the situation regarding transport under the NDIS. What are they actually doing? Because we're getting mixed reports, I think. On the one hand, we're being told, oh, no, the taxi vouchers, you know, won't be affected. But on the other hand, it's, well, I'm hearing the transport is supposed to be rolled into your NDIS package. Now, but certainly getting back to the O&M training, though, it is quite a more serious matter when one isn't that good with spatial concepts. And I feel that the training should be focused more generally on getting people aware, more spatially aware about their general surroundings, rather than trying to always, you know, focus on specifics like A and B and C, and we're, you know, boxed into this sort of pattern now more and more, where you've got to actually fill in a program, a form justifying, you know, the goals and objectives, in order so that, you know, the blindness agencies can justify them taking you on for whatever the length of the program is, whether it's 6 weeks or 12 weeks or whatever.
That's good. No, it's good that you've spoken about the mobility, because often that can really make you very low on confidence if those services, you know, those needs are not met through the service.
Yes.
But I think, so that we don't confuse listeners, it is important, you know, to say that, you know, listeners, the mobility services are not actually provided by the NDIS. They're provided by Vision Australia and various other organisations around Australia. But I suppose, and please correct me if I'm wrong here, Vivian, but from what I can see here, the NDIS is actually paying for block funding, but if people run out, what are they going to do? And, you know, but anyway, we're going to be running out of time pretty soon. So are there any other areas that you want to concentrate on? I mean, for example, technology, Braille production, library services. How have you found those?
Well, throughout my studies, which was, of course, way before the concept of the NDIS came about, here,
yeah.
I certainly had plenty of experience of having to fight to get hold of materials. I did find that during my language studies, because when I was doing Italian and German, I actually made extensive use of overseas materials, which was great. It was a great help, even though I also took up the challenge then of learning other countries' Braille codes. It was when I got to my second degree that the fun and games really started, so to speak, because I was doing Japanese and Indonesian at that time, and Japanese certainly was not something that the transcribers here were familiar with. It's a completely different Braille code, as well as their writing system. So it was the case in the end of very much networking with organisations in Japan and a lot of direct contact with them in order to get material transcribed. But I found on top of that I was dealing with bureaucracy towards the end of the second year of my study with the university, because their department was wanting to, you know, get involved and get me the equity funding, which is wonderful, except they couldn't decide what was going to be the appropriate assessment for my written work in the third year, because by this time there was no way for me to produce the actual Japanese writing at that time.
I see. So what you're basically saying, Vivian, because I've got someone else I have to interview. I'm really sorry, but in summary, what you're saying then is that you weren't getting, and it's a good example that you've used here. You're not getting things in a timely manner.
Yeah,
and they didn't have an understanding of the language either, did they? There was a lot of problems here. of the, the Braille.
Well, the department, yeah, that's right. They didn't have that understanding about Braille, and yet I had been already, you know, doing the running around myself, getting things organised.
It's very difficult.
Very frustrating.
It's extremely frustrating.
And bureaucratic.
It is bureaucratic, and I go on. Go on.
I think today it's fair to say that technology has come about and very much levelled the playing field to some extent, but at the same time it's been quite a mixed blessing because we also have the issue of website accessibility to fight for, on the other hand, which, you know, wasn't such an issue before. I mean, who had even heard of the internet?
Absolutely.
I was entering uni. So it's still very much on the agenda that now with the digital technology, especially the Braille-related equipment is quite pricey. It's not something that's within the range of the average to low-income earners. So,
oh, yes.
It's another battle again. But at the same time, it's also been a great boon because if one does get on the internet, you then find that a whole host of information does become available. Email communication with friends is a great thing.
It is. It is.
Not having to rely on so much printed matter.
And I think for you, one of the things that I feel that's coming through for you, Vivian, is that you know, your digital needs are not being met quite a lot of the time, and your mobility needs aren't being met at this stage.
Yeah, that's right. It's still something that very much is a work in progress. I and certainly others, especially I think Braille users, are really noticing the expense involved in maintaining the, for example, a Braille display. Even if one is lucky enough, as I was a few years ago, to acquire a Braille display, if the battery gets to the stage that it's running low and it actually needs replacing, then you've got to send it away. And it doesn't actually, it's not something that one can go to one's local electronic store.
And hereby, that's the non-optional cost of disability, isn't it?
Yeah.
And this is where the NEIS comes in, and, you know, we don't have much time to talk about that now. We'll have to do a longer program at some other stage. But, you know, one of the things that I experienced when I was doing my plan and I decided actually not to go onto the NEIS is that the NEIS actually wanted me to get an assessment done. And I knew exactly what type of technology I wanted. And they kind of acted like I had a real chip on my shoulder, like they were saying, oh, but we need to work out what type of technology you need. That's not the way it is. I knew what I needed, and there could have been a lot of time and money wasted there, you know, doing that.
The trouble is these people that are the power brokers, I think, now with the NDIS, a lot of them, I'm finding the feedback that I'm hearing about is they're not that expert in the areas that they want to be experts in for the equipment that the participant needs. And the participant does the running around, does their research to death, knows about Braille equipment. Now, I'm all for, you know, fine, assess things, get your paperwork done, that kind of stuff, but for goodness sake, not to this point where you're actually dragging somebody through an unnecessary level of bureaucracy.
Absolutely, and I think that there's got to be more planning. You know, the plans are very ill-equipped. It's a one-size-fits-all. Vivian, thank you so much for coming onto the program. It's been lovely to have you. And we'll have to chat some other time. Thank you very, very much. You'll be able to get this on podcast when it becomes available.
Thank you. Thanks for having me again.
Thank you, Vivian. Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you too. Bye-bye.
And that was Vivian Palchik speaking about the lived experience of blindness. We'll be going into an announcement now.
For people with disabilities all around the world to have their say and be able to stand up for their rights and and also should be given a try at new skills and knowledge, and we're all out there and we've got abilities to do things all we need is people to take off their horse glasses and see us.
Hi, this is Gary. You're listening to 3CR and we're celebrating International Day Disability.
Australia has to do better for Aboriginal people with disabilities. Australia has to do better for women with disabilities. Australia must close institutions that are still open. And people in sheltered workshops are paid unfair wage. That must stop now. Nothing about us without us.
You're back with Disability Pride Program. Hello, Duncan. Welcome.
Hello, how are you going?
Yeah, sorry, we just had a few technical difficulties there, but you're on air, and it's approximately 1:36. Yeah, good to have you, Duncan.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so, Duncan, I'm wondering, look, I said in the intro of the show that you're actually running a furniture design business, and yep. You've also got a vision impairment. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so I suppose I run a small designer maker business that makes lights and furniture. And I suppose I do that, and I operate in a world with a disability. So I have less than 5% vision concentrated around the peripheries. I use a range of assistive technologies in order to do that. But I also, I suppose, have my work is in, often also informed by my disability. So a lot of my lights are about dispersing light through and around an object, similar in some respects to my visual fields in terms of dispersing light around the peripheries.
That's fantastic. So you use obviously a lot of tools that help you as a vision impaired person for that. No, that's great. I mean, look, I'm not here on the show to say how inspirational you are and all that type of stuff, because, you know, you're using your talents and your gifts, right? So, but I think it's always good to educate listeners, isn't it, about this stuff?
Yeah, well, I suppose for me, I think it's an interesting conversation to have, not just for people with disabilities, but also for people, you know, quote unquote, without disabilities, whatever that may mean.
Yeah.
But, you know, in terms of people with blindness and vision impairment, I think sometimes the biggest barriers may be the attitudinal ones, whether it be people's own, with, you know, internal ones, because of societal norms, or whether it be the, I suppose, the societal norms themselves. So, you know, one example of that would be one of the education departments at one point around Australia limited about things that people with vision impairment or legally blind people could do, and that's a huge spectrum, legally blind, but won't go too much into that right now, but they wouldn't let them use scissors.
Really?
Yeah, and, you know, when they let their sighted counterparts in the education system let them use scissors. So sort of when are the people going to learn how to use scissors other than at school? So, you know, it's kind of creating the disability as opposed to trying to help overcome it. So it sort of shows that it goes away from the health model. I mean, that shows exactly how the health model of disability works. It rather than utilising the, I suppose, the societal one, which, there's a bit of an interesting theory in and of itself that not necessarily all people in the disability sector have heard of.
You know, Duncan, I actually am really glad that you're on the show. I have found the whole process, and I'm going to say this live on air, I don't care what people think, I have found it extremely difficult to organise this program, and I'll tell you why. Because of the fact that a lot of blind and vision impaired people, and in particular, are too frightened to come onto the radio. They're too frightened to talk about themselves. They are too afraid to talk about the disability insurance scheme, for example, because they're frightened that they'll be told that they have to be grateful for what they have. And they're too frightened to talk about their own experiences. Isn't that sad? Why do you think that is?
I don't necessarily think it's just about blindness and vision impairment there either, because I think it is quite an intimidating thing for someone to get on air and talk.
Oh, no, absolutely, but I'm not talking about that.
Especially when there are power relations involved.
Sure.
But also, I think, the NDIS is an interesting model, and it does move away from as paternalistic model that we have had in the past, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it is perfect, but that doesn't mean that it should be entirely scrapped. But I think that if we can try and look at working through that together as much as possible and really work at making the disability policy not just about people with disabilities, but including them in the decision-making processes as much as possible as well. And that's a really complicated thing because I think people forget how big the disability sector is. And I think that's a big conversation to have and just categorically saying it's about, you know, in terms of big overarching statements about one particular facet of disability, it's really, I think, tricky because blindness itself is such a huge
yes,
spectrum.
Yes, it is. Absolutely.
And equally with the disability, I think the disability NDIS stuff, it has had a bit of difficulty in terms of it got pulled in with Medicare and got called their disability care plan at one stage. And for me, I think that's problematic because we don't necessarily always need care.
Correct.
There are different spectrums within the disability, sector. And, you know, there are some people with disabilities that their main disability is that they can't access certain information.
Everyone's different.
And in order to access that information, that will empower them to be able to actually do their job, or will empower them to go and get a job, or will empower them to go to university. And I've had experiences of going to university before where that information hasn't been there. And that wasn't because of lack of funding. It was part of it was because of lack of systems being put in place. And I think that's the big problem, is really needs to have overhauls of how disability is looked at, and really trying to have the thing of what's known as universal access as much as possible as well.
Thank you. Yeah, that's exactly right, Duncan. And I just wanted to touch you made a really good point before about people being really nervous on air, but I think it's also the fact that a lot of people with disabilities do feel very, very disempowered, and you don't, obviously, but some do, and I think we all do feel disempowered at one stage, and we need to admit that. And yeah. I think one of the issues that I found is I had people saying, "Look, Marissa, I'm really sorry. I'd love to join you, but I'm frightened to say what I need to say in case I get into trouble."
Mm.
Do you know what I'm trying to say?
I know exactly what you're trying to say, and you know, it'd be a great shame if that was the case. You know, would really hope that that wouldn't be the case, and hopefully anyone involved in that particular decision-making process is listening to that, you know, that statement right now, because I think the thing is, you know, I think people do need to be able to be critical, but it also needs to be a criticism in terms of trying to figure out how to move forward in
constructive
terms of the current context as well.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, for me, I think the NDIS, the biggest problem for me isn't necessarily just the individual, it's also about the way that the whole system's changed, where a lot of the disability NGOs and community sector have now had to spend more money in terms of marketing than actually deliver their actual process, because it's changed what was, you know, disability, looking after, having people with disability being empowered or looked after, and not saying that was necessarily the old model, but I'm saying that this could be an alternative model, and looked at it from a perspective of commodities and exchanging commodities, and that this is effectively commodified and corporatized in some respects, a fairly interesting sector that's still in some respects in its infancy and also a bit amorphic in terms of where it's going for, at the moment.
Look, it's true. And in fact, to quote from BCA's, Bill Blyson's Australia, own submission to the Productivity Commission, that, you know, the current planning process of vision impaired people is ill-equipped to meet the needs of people whose support needs are largely episodic, you know? So, yeah.
And I suppose going back to that, because I've read an interesting article recently through Art Texas Australia. I can't actually remember the author. She's a writer.
yeah. got a few degrees, and she's not blind, but she's got a fairly severe disability, mobility disability. Can't necessarily remember what that was from. But the thing that I found quite interesting from that was she said that she got confused. And so we're talking about people that have got like postgraduate education, not just having a bachelor's degree, but having master's degrees and things like that as well. Very high level of education, getting confused, but also getting infantilized in some respects, because what's happening in that process, and I've actually been through the process myself, so it's not talking from my own personal experience, it's talking from the experience of reading this article. She said she went into the meeting with the NDIS, and the meeting was good, but there was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing. But the way that the system works is it's an offer gets put down on the table, and you either have to accept it or not accept it. Mm-hmm. And I'm in a situation where I run a small business, and it's quite interesting to see that, because it's just kind of like a bit of a laugh in some respects, because it's not necessarily seeing the person with a disability as being able to offer something as a result of having this thing, of getting access to certain technology or access to having certain assistance. And because that's the point of it. It's not necessarily just here's your cake and be happy or whatever. It's about, here's something that, you know, will help sustain you in order to be able to contribute to society in whatever way, shape or form that individual could.
So do you do your design on the computer? Describe what you would do in a day.
For example. Depends on every day.
What's the process?
For my designing process is quite an interesting one, because I actually probably design better with actual materials or paper or cardboard in terms of playing around with type plans, anything. So some of my models are quite crude, and it's really about representing a form. But I also do draw sometimes with a big fat marker, and that big fat marker, well, not heaps of people can necessarily understand, but through discussions with that and the crude models, sometimes I then engage a drafter who then can do the drawings of my computers with me, and we can then enlarge the drawings as they go and have a look. So because a lot of those drawings aren't really designed in order for a vision-impaired person to use them, it's really faster and better for me to be able to do that, because I can zoom in sometimes, but I get fatigued quite quickly with my vision. So I try and avoid using the magnification as much as possible. And I do, there are certain key commands, but sometimes it's just better to know where your strengths are. And I suppose for me, my strength is designing the actual through thought pattern and then conveying it in some way in which it can then be turned into computerized drawing. Or sometimes I then just go straight into it for myself and just know, okay, these are the measurements of what I'm going to make, and then go straight onto the tools and make the thing, or go straight into the tools and make what's called a mock-up. So just a full-scale model, which is then, crudely put together with screws or whatever. And then there's the final, then you tweak it a bit, figure out exactly what you want to do, and then the final thing is made. But, like, for example, one of the designs I made took 3 or 4 years to design, and I had to walk away from it for a year or two because it just, it's a fairly large process involved in it. And I suppose that's the interesting thing about design is a lot of people don't quite understand is that there is a fair bit of time that does go into design of some things, especially from the small scale designer maker perspective, when they're trying to make design and make something that's going to last for a long period of time.
So what sort of furniture do you design and make?
There's a range of things. Most of it's handmade timber. I've made some metal lights and some porcelain lights, and I've done the initial prototyping, or involved in the initial prototyping, and some parts of it then get outsourced to other people. So the clip casting of the porcelain light I make is outsourced to a local artisan. After sort of the original sort of half dozen were made, by myself, assistance from someone else, just sort of working out the processes, because of the process I've never really used before. So my strength is what I'm trying to say in a long-winded way is timber work. So I do one of the big, most popular designs I do is a log with the core removed and light coming out of the crack.
Oh, the lamp.
Of the log, yeah, log. So there's a lamp version of it in terms of just the table light and very much mood lighting. And, it is interesting for someone with low vision because it is very much about contrast. And lighting generally is, in my opinion, often about contrast. Good lighting and being able... And then there's also there's these downlight pendant lights, which are the same thing, but they hang from the ceiling. And then there's a big version of it which you can sit on. And then there are other ones that I've done which are like a
a floral propeller inspired thing, and then there's other furniture like little miniature cabinets or larger cabinets, and coffee tables, and coffee tables with like leaf shaped legs and a blown up triangle. So very much a fairly broad range of things still, even though they're made out of timber.
Fantastic. Look, I hope it's been okay to have the interview extended a little bit here.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, Duncan, the other area I'd like to concentrate on, and I don't want you to think that I'm putting you on the spot here, but I did read an old article that was actually in Green Left Weekly some years ago now about the fact that you had been discriminated against with employment at some banks. Is that correct?
No, I was never employed by a bank. I'm not sure what article.
Oh, that's interesting. We'll have to talk about that later.
Yes,
because
I have had discrimination in a workplace, but just going back, I suppose.
Oh, okay. Maybe it wasn't the bank. Could you detail that?
Yeah, we can talk about that in a sec. But just going back to the furniture stuff, because I suppose the problem is often with the discrimination is getting caught up necessarily on the discrimination, because it is a really bad thing. But
it is.
Going back to some of the stuff in terms of trying to avoid necessarily having that discrimination and looking at things in an alternative way, I got, you know, in terms of the positive situation, but in terms of my disability and being in, and I'm totally out for answering that question in a sec.
But sure.
While I'm on the furniture design stuff, I got accepted to the university down here in terms of doing furniture, and I've got a really big amount of respect for the community down here in furniture design.
Good.
Because they're still continually inclusive, and I think part of that is because of the independent way that designers think, that they think about things from an alternative perspective. And I suppose that's why it's really interesting to have design and disability as two things that are interlocked in my case. And the teacher at the time, Linda Fredheim, was very open to having me there. And she and I continue to work in a professional capacity with each other and in the community down here.
That's fantastic, isn't it?
And going on from that there's a lot of technology out there, and I'm more than willing to answer emails and stuff if people do have questions about how I do my work, because I think a lot of the time people think, this guy, you know, he's just, it's just an inbuilt talent. But a lot of it is life chances and having situations where people are open-minded. And
how can people get in touch with you?
Just through my website, which is www.duncanmeeting.com.au. If you just Google Duncan and Log Light, it should come up. So that's probably the best way for people to remember.
No, that's fantastic.
Yeah. So I can talk to people about the talking tape measures and stuff later. But, yeah, sorry.
Talking tape measures now, yeah. You know what it is? There's never enough time, is there, Duncan? And I've really tried to, have a balanced perspective, positive and negative. But we don't have to talk about the discrimination if you don't want to.
No, I can talk about that. But that particular case was very old now.
It is.
2005. And it was an interesting situation because it does go back to what people can and can't do with disabilities. And maybe it wasn't necessarily something that may have had to happen eventually, but the way in which it happened was not necessarily the best process, because I was working as an orderly when my vision first began.
Oh, I see.
Medical orderly. That was at one of the hospitals in Tasmania. And there was a case of which the hospital did offer to give look at alternative arrangements for the employment, but when it came too hard for them, I suppose, but also, that I brought up that maybe it was a good idea for me to take a bit of a step back, and then we look at the new arrangement. The shifts were just cut because I was a casual, and that does go back to, I suppose, the way that not just people with disabilities, but how all people in the employment sector are dealt with. There are other probably stronger, closer, or more recent cases of discrimination that I've encountered from in terms of indirect discrimination at the universities.
Absolutely.
Or discrimination on the airplane. I was involved in a bit of a unofficial class action against one of the airlines, and they weren't allowing people to fly without a carer, the precise wording was without anyone that required any form of assistance wasn't allowed to fly without a carer. And for me, that's kind of a bit of a joke, because I've travelled around the world by myself before, including to India and including to South America and Europe.
That's great.
And it's, ultimately it is a bit of a challenge, but it's a challenge for anyone to travel.
Absolutely.
with or without a disability as well.
You know, Duncan, that's great. And getting back to the technology, it's really fantastic that you mentioned the talking tape measure.
Yeah.
That's actually really good, and that would be... Can you buy those?
Yeah. So they're actually available through Vision Australia, and I've also just... also just quickly while I remember, just to finish off on that conversation about the discrimination, that class action was successful and the policy was changed. So that's the thing is, just being discriminated against doesn't necessarily mean that's the end of the story. There are plenty of avenues in order to be able to challenge that. So that's the thing, like the Anti-Discrimination Commission, the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission and things like that are useful things to be involved in if something bad happens, and really recommend the community legal centres and things like that that help with those things. But in terms of going back to the technology, you can buy the talking tape measures through Vision Australia, and I think there are other avenues as well. But
fantastic.
There's also another mainstream company in the US that's just been developing something. I only just discovered this in the last week, and it really made my day. They're developing something that's really affordable, and it's just utilizing apps and Bluetooth, so that they'll be able to, that people are able to use. There's what's called an angle finding gauge, which I utilize a lot in the workshop, and currently, I've been trying to use a very high-powered magnifier, and it's quite difficult to use it. But then what the new one is you can link it to your iPhone or to your Android device or something like that, and it will then read what's on the gauge and tell you the precise angle that you're setting the table for, whatever, to. And then there are other things like the protractor that they're now developing. And this is a mainstream company that's working in conjunction with the blind community in the US, and I only found out about this because they're leading the way in terms of affordable technology for sighted, for being able to make precise equipment cages. The idea is that they're also now looking at doing that to people with blindness and vision impairment, and I think that's really good because sometimes that's not always the case in terms of accessibility stuff because it's such a niche market, but also, it's always a bit problematic when you're running an economically driven business in an assistive field.
Absolutely.
Like disability.
We're going to run out of time soon, but that's fantastic, Duncan, and that's hopefully we can keep an eye on that space. Tell us your website quickly. We've only got a minute left.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Marissa. Sorry, I'm a bit of a low sometimes.
What's your website?
That's right. www.duncanmeeting, so D-U-N-C-A-N,
yep.
M for Michael, two E's, R-D-I-N-G. Yep.
And just to correct something on air, that wasn't you with the bank. You wrote an article for Green Left Weekly about a guy that was another blind person that was discriminated against, Bernard Hemmings, who spoke to Green Left Weekly about his experience applying for work at Citibank.
Yep.
You know about that. It's approximately 1:57. We've spoken to Duncan. Thank you to all our guests, but we've actually spoken to Duncan about his technology in regards to not just the lived experience of blindness, but also and vision impairment, but also in terms of his furniture design business. And I found it absolutely fascinating. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you. And if anyone does ever want to ask questions of how to get involved in that sort of sector, feel free to email me.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me, Marissa. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And if people want to know more about Duncan, call 3CR on 9419 8377 and I'll put you in touch. And we have our next disability programmer coming in soon. Thank you to everybody for listening. Bye.